Broadcasting out of unceded Gadigal country, this is Liquid Homelands presented by Race Matters, a queer experimental radio project dissolving the confines of audio and identity.
This piece has been recorded and written on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people. Their land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Hi, my name is Tori. I'm a queer, disabled carer and writer living on Ngunnawal and Ngambri land. I began my education and practice as a registered nurse on Bunurong land, and I guess I use my experience as a healthcare worker and as a disabled person to inform my clinical practice, but also my writing and advocacy work. I try and focus a lot of my energy into providing care, advocacy and support for people with disabilities in my community. This piece is about, I guess, my journey as a disabled person and as a queer person of colour, and the different places and times that I called home, maybe. It was a bit full on to write, because there's certain, you know, parts of my life and my history and my relationship to my family and home which can be a bit complex and uncomfortable at times. But I've tried to sort of, you know, talk about things that are relatable for disabled people, and I guess the disabled experience growing up with a disability and being, you know, just having to navigate your space and your role in your family and in your community, and how you can meaningfully engage with the people around you. So that's kind of what this is about. When you grow up a certain way, for a while you think that that's the only way to live, where difference is punished, where your life and the expectations you have to live up to are so rigid and unbreakable that you can't fathom another way of living. I spent most of my childhood in the southeast suburbs of Victoria, Bunurong land. I was immersed in so many different cultures growing up. I was surrounded by people that looked like me. There were a handful of white people in my class. All the Sri Lankan kids in my school knew each other. Our parents went to the same spice shops in Noble Park. They went to school with each other. Their cousin's sister-in-law knew your nana. They held you as a baby for some reason. Our mums all went to the same obstetrician. We couldn't walk through our local shopping centre on a Saturday without bumping into some auntie who would squeeze my face repeatedly and gossip with my mum about other people they know. The same scenes of men drinking and yelling as their wives served them dinner and refilled their glasses of Red Label would repeat like clockwork every weekend. I had resigned myself to the fact that this was just life, that it'll always be this way, and that the standards I, my family and my community were willing to accept were acceptable because there was no other way. There was one way to have a family, and there was one way to exist as a community. and all other ways were weird and strange and obscene. I tried prayer. I tried confiding in my parents and friends. I tried writing in diaries. I tried writing songs. I tried whatever a 9-year-old tries during their existential crises. I shut my eyes tight every night under my doona and wished and wished and wished I felt differently. I wished I felt normal and not like I was crawling out of my skin every second of every day. But how can you imagine another way when you're repeatedly told there is none?
Honestly, if I tell you what you wanna know, love, there ain't another, don't want no other lover. I put nothing above ya, I kick 'em to the gutter. You try to shake me, wind up loving me crazy. Now look at us lately and tell them who's your lady.
I never thought you'd be the one, make me shine brighter than the sun.
There ain't no ups and downs, no winning else, you're here right now.
If you want me to stay, I'll never leave. If you want me to stay, we'll always be. If you want me to stay, love endlessly. If you want me to stay, if you want me to stay, I'll never leave you.
When I was in grade 4, I watched as every channel on TV played footage of wave after wave, clearing village after village. We watched as breakfast show hosts showed videos filmed on cameras of tourists and locals. 20-foot waves destroying hotels, sweeping people kilometres inland, demolishing my nana's home. We waited for days to hear from our family, who all turned out to be safe as they were further inland that day. Except for my uncle, who sought refuge in a coconut tree. I was given little warning that we were moving. I was sad to be leaving, but I didn't have a choice. I just had to do it. And even then, in my little baby brain, I knew why I was so sad to leave. I knew what it meant to move somewhere where I had no friends and didn't know the language. I was terrified. I missed my first ever school camp to Ballarat because we were flying out the next week and my parents didn't want me to get gastro, which everyone pretty much did, according to my friends. I remember playing video games on the plane and the wave of the heat when I stepped out of the airport for the first time in the place that I would call home for the next 18 months. I would experience so many firsts here. I saw my first snake in the wild. My first blood clot, my first Nokia 6100, my first seizure, my first cool pet, a tortoise named Flash, my first sexual assault, my first MP3 player, my first home invasion, my first crush on a girl, my first episode of medical negligence, my first compulsion, my first sand crab. My first bomb scare. My first panic attack. My first public execution.
At my international school in Sri Lanka, I stuck out. I towered above everyone else. I felt dorky in my uniform, and I was forced to braid my hair as it was compulsory. I struggled to braid it myself. Every day my mum braided my hair as I stood in the kitchen, and every day I'd come home with my braid falling apart. One day I was running late for school, and mum was unable to braid my hair. I got to school and was in the corridor when I was spotted by the sport teacher. She took one look at my hair and screamed at me, calling me an idiot as she ran into the classroom. She came out with a ruler, and in front of the half the year level, she grabbed my hand, turned it palm side up, and slapped it hard. Between violence at home, bullying from teachers, constant illness, not being fluent in the language, and relentless sexual harassment from kids in my school and random men on the street, I became more and more isolated. There was no escape. I was either having my breasts grabbed by strangers on the street or having my vagina examined by doctors. No one knew what to do with me. My body wasn't mine anymore. Nowhere felt like home to me. I was in this place and it was beautiful. I was with people who looked like me, but it didn't feel right. I was always told that I was meant to feel some connection to this. My parents always called Sri Lanka back home when we lived in Australia, but it wasn't home for me. If home wasn't the country I live in, or the house I slept in, or the body I walk in, then where was it? My dad always says the reason we moved to Sri Lanka was because of me, to fix me. Seeing real poverty and real broken people would change me. I was broken in a different way and he needed to fix me. I'd learn to cry about the right things at the right time. I'd complain about my pain less and I'd put up with more. And I did. We eventually moved back to Victoria and moved into a house a bit further south than where we originally lived. When my parents told me we were coming back, I was overjoyed. I couldn't wait to be back. I had friends here and family I could speak to. I ended up going to a high school around the same area I grew up, a single-sex Catholic school, I spent much of my first few years of high school floating between friend groups. Like many teenagers, I often felt misunderstood by my friends and like I didn't belong. Although I didn't identify as being disabled back then, my disability and its symptoms became the butt of every joke. I was the girl with the crazy periods. I was the one who had huge boobs and couldn't do sport or swim in carnivals because I was either fainting, bleeding, or both. I know now that they just didn't understand why I was like this. To them and everyone else, it was just heavy periods. But they didn't see the other symptoms. The vomiting, fainting, the pain I went through daily, sometimes for months at a time. I didn't expect anything from them. I mean, my own parents saw these symptoms, and I was repeatedly told by them and every doctor I'd seen that it was normal. I was a completely normal teenage girl. After years of trying to get help, I did what my parents and doctors asked of me. I put up with it. I got used to the pain and the bleeding. It became a part of me that just was. I couldn't change it because there was nothing that needed changing. Like all teenagers, I eventually discovered the internet. I found people with similar interests, who listened to the same music and watched the same TV shows. Every night I would plug the blue Ethernet cable into my laptop and talk for hours to people across the world. I felt really cool doing it. It was the internet that made me realize I was queer. I had always known I was attracted to people regardless of their gender. It was a part of me that I hadn't given much thought to. I feel like I didn't have the time or space to think about it. I grew up in a house where homophobic slurs were thrown around daily, where my parents called my auntie's husband gay for washing the dishes and cooking for his children. I grew up knowing no queer people. The internet and Ryan Murphy's Glee were the reason I came out to my mum in the car on the way home from a party in year 10. I finally knew queer people, and for the first time, I felt kind of normal. If people on the internet and TV tell me it's okay, then it is. She reacted by pulling over and accused me of being drunk. I got home and went straight to my room to await my punishment. She told my dad. And he grabbed me by the shoulders and shook me so violently that I saw stars. I was told I had demons inside me, that my sexuality was a sign that they'd failed as parents, that this part of me cannot and does not exist, and that if I wanted to live this way, then I should go live somewhere else. I quickly learnt that this part of me was, again, something I needed to keep for myself. Something to put away. So I adapted, and I was a different person with my family. I was a different person with my friends from school, and I was a different person on the internet. When I was finishing school, my queer internet friends became queer real-life friends. I built a rich community online and felt like I'd finally found a place for me. Except this one didn't feel right either. I often noticed at parties and in my friend groups that I was the only one who wasn't white. And now, whilst my queerness was accepted, I still felt out of place. My race had become the thing people made jokes about. I was given terrible racist nicknames and felt awkward discussing issues surrounding racism and white supremacy. I eventually befriended more South Asians and other non-white people online and felt more comfortable discussing this part of my life with others. And as I did, I grew more isolated from those friends. I was too vocal now about the issues I faced as a brown person. I complained too much. I felt like I was back at square one. I needed to complain less and put up with more, but I couldn't.
Thank you.
When I finished my degree, I saved every cent and moved nearly 1,000 kilometres away from where I grew up. I moved in with my partner and we built a life together. The first year after I moved was a massive adjustment. Now that I was in a place where all these parts of me could exist without fear of repercussions, I didn't know how to cope with it. I couldn't understand it. I knew I was safe here and I felt more comfortable here, but I had this impending sense of doom. I woke up every day waiting for the rug to be pulled out from underneath me. I started seeing a psychologist. I'd learnt that I'd developed complex post-traumatic stress disorder. After experiencing family violence and medical neglect throughout my whole life, I'd adapted in strange ways. And now I had this new life, a safe one, where I couldn't be told how to live or how to feel. It was all up to me, and I just didn't know how to live like that. Like clockwork, as soon as I moved, my chronic pain became worse. Pain that used to be a monthly occurrence soon became weekly, then daily. I quickly went from juggling full-time work in a major public hospital, volunteer advocacy work, and going out and partying with my friends, to spending most days in bed, unable to work more than 8 hours a fortnight. I was struggling financially, physically, and mentally. Suddenly, this community that I'd felt so at home in, that I used to share the deepest parts of myself with, was gone. I could no longer engage with the queer community like I used to. Instead of going out on a Friday night, I spent the night at home on my couch, unable to walk to the bathroom, let alone out the front door. I was giving myself burns on my stomach and back from constantly strapping hot water bottles to myself. I became reliant on opioids to do the most basic of tasks. I was seeing my GP more than my own friends. And those friends I'd once held so close were slipping away. The more transparent I became about my health online, the more distance grew between me and the people I considered my best friends. The nature of my disability carries so much stigma, and I knew that, but I never expected my friends, who were queer and progressive, to react the way they did. I was no longer able to engage with my queer friends on their terms. I couldn't go to parties or to see our friends' bands play at inaccessible venues anymore. I wasn't fun to be around anymore. When people asked me how I was, I'd either lie and say I was good, or tell the truth and watch them disappear from my life. I could no longer engage with the queer community on their terms. The disposability that disabled people experience is hard to explain. For so many people, it's linked to something you cannot change, cannot do, or cannot be. Parts of you for which there is no cure. The parts of you that you have to adapt, manage and change in order to survive in a world, in a community that does not want to change for you. My world became very small very quickly, much like it was before when I was a kid. Except this time my home was the only space I felt safe in. I retreated again to the internet, but this time I was connecting with disabled people. I found spaces where disabled people, many of which queer themselves, had made communities built on support and love for one another, built from the remains of the communities a lot of us once felt safe in. When I was younger, I built my community around the part of me I valued most, around the part of me that felt the most vulnerable. There was no place for me in my birth family. There was no place for me in the land they called home. Through building relationships online as a young person, I found solidarity and understanding. A community I thought that would always be there to support me, just as I had them. The queer community held me through those difficult times in my life, but it was conditional and finite. A lot of abled people say to disabled people that our disabilities shouldn't define us. We're more than our special needs. We're just differently abled. The queer community's inability to see my disability and race, and their reluctance to accommodate and accept it, meant I had to find my home elsewhere. I found my home with my partner, with my siblings and my dog, with my budgies and my plants, with my patients at work, and with my TV, podcasts and video games, with my friends who understand. I found my true home and my true place in this world, and it turns out I didn't have to change a thing.
Sitting at this party, wondering if anyone knows me, really sees who I am. Oh, it's been so long since I fell.
ultimate hidden truth of the world is that it is something we make and could just as easily make differently.
You've been listening to an audio offering from the Liquid Homeland series, presented by Race Matters. This was one part of an 8-part sonic anthology with creators across cultural and creative experiences and geographies. FBI Radio broadcasts out of stolen Gadigal country and is indebted to the legacy of resistance and storytelling that has existed here before us and will continue to long after us. The series theme was sound designed by Witching. The visuals were created by Tiberius Larking with art direction by Tim Wharton. The series was conceptualized and gathered by myself, Sharika Helaludin, with the title inspired by the writing of Ruby Sarkar. Liquid Homelands was made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. To learn more about what we do here at Race Matters, you can visit fbiradio.com/racematters.